Well, it was a long old wait, but when the white smoke finally puffed above the Man Booker judging chamber late on Wednesday afternoon, you could hear the hoops of jubilation ringing through The Guardian. Not least because we on the Books podcast have championed most of the contenders over the last few months. I know, it's not decent to blow one's own trumpet, but I just can't resist a little toot. With me to discuss the 2010 longlist are Sarah Crown from the Books website and Rodney Trowbridge from Waterstones. Sarah, is this a surprise for you, this list?
Yes, I think it was a surprise. A lot of the big names that could potentially have been on there aren't, and that for me felt like good news this year because it's diverse, it's interesting, it has really brilliant authors who I really thought wouldn't be picked up. So it's, yeah, a lovely surprise.
Rodney, how about your response? I mean, you're looking at it from the point of view of a bookseller, the person who has to put these on into people's pockets.
Yeah, I was on tenterhooks all day, much more so than I expected, actually, and I certainly than in previous years, but somehow I felt very, very excited. I think it's full of really, really good books. And I feel that both as a retailer, but also as a personal reader, I think there are some things that I really, really want to rush off with and read.
We'll be coming to what the particular ones you want to read a little bit later. But perhaps what was most surprising of all about this list is that there is one book that's yet to be published. Emma Donoghue's Room doesn't come out till next month, but the buzz has been building all year. We're going to talk to her now on the phone. Hi, Emma. Congratulations. What does it feel like to get this news?
Oh, I'm absolutely amazed. I don't really follow these things. You know, I never look out for the dates that these things are likely to be announced. So I had no idea it was even coming up. And I had certainly no idea that Room was going to get on the long list. So I'm just blown away.
It's already been published in Ireland, hasn't it? But you're just setting off on holiday before the big onslaught of publication in England happens. Is that right?
Yeah, it's not actually published yet. It's just the Irish Review started coming in early, maybe enthusiasm for one of their own.
They've been good, have they?
Oh, yes, the reviews in the Irish Times and the Irish Independent have been comparing me with, you know, Beckett and Solzhenitsyn. I couldn't even pronounce Solzhenitsyn, let alone spell him, so I'm deeply honoured.
So now tell us where you are now. I can hear a bit of a hubbub in the background.
I'm in the middle of Stansted Airport on our way from Wales to the south of France with my partner and two small kids. So it's a little crazy, but it's also quite exciting getting thrilling news like this in the middle of a family trip, you know. It's the opposite of the kind of motherhood experience in Room, which is so isolated and private.
Emma, thank you very much. Have a lovely holiday, and I hope that we'll meet very soon when you get back.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye. Emma Donoghue, currently on a plane in the clouds somewhere above you, and that doesn't just refer to the euphoria. Her novel Room is published next month by Picador. Rodney, does the longlist actually make a difference to booksellers? We know that the winner always does very well, but how about these 13?
Well, I think it's an interesting one, and I feel there's a bit more of a buzz about this year's longlist, and I'm not quite sure I know why, but I think it's partly because of what's on it. But we certainly are encouraging our shops to do as much with them as possible.
Now, when I asked for speculative suggestions on Twitter last week, one of the issues that came up was whether there would be any women on it. And Flossie Teacake tweeted, "Oh God, please not an all-male long list. I might cry." Well, Sarah, Flossie Teacake doesn't have to cry.
No, she has nothing to worry about. There were five women to seven men on the long list. I think that the concern came from the fact that last year was very women-heavy, and obviously, finally, Hilary Mantel went on to win the Booker for Wolf Hall. But this year, I was thinking beforehand, before the announcement, and thinking probably Helen Dunmore will be on and probably Andrea Levy will be on. These are five good books. I think they're five brilliant books. I was particularly pleased to see Lisa Moore on there for February because she's a Canadian author. She's done very well over there. She's won the Commonwealth Prize for a previous novel, but she's very little known over here. And her book, it's called February. It came out in February and I reviewed it back then. And I thought, this is such a good book, just absolutely brilliant, based on a real life sinking of an oil rig and the story that spins out of that. But I just assumed it was one of those great books that you will occasionally tell people about and say, you know, you really should read this, and they won't read it and it will disappear without a trace. And it's wonderful to see it being recognised.
It sort of has disappeared without a trace, hasn't it, up to this point?
It has, actually, and I don't imagine it sold many copies, but this is what's so exciting about prizes, is that they give them a wonderful boost.
I absolutely love the Andrea Levy. She hasn't just tried to repeat her prize-winning success. It's very much got Lawrence Stern, Tristram Shandy, breathing down its neck. And it's a story of slavery. It's incredibly witty and funny. And is this one that's gone down well, Rodney?
Absolutely. It was our book of the month back in February, and I'm a huge fan of hers as well. And what's so wonderful is it's quite a long time between her previous book and this one, and my goodness, she's put that time to good use.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sarah, you're a big fan of Helen Dunmore's Betrayal, aren't you?
Yes, this is her sequel to The Seed, which set in Soviet Russia. Very gripping, very big book about the siege of Leningrad at the end of the Second World War. And The Betrayal brings us up to about 1950 and the Doctor's Plot, just about a year before Stalin died. And it's just a completely brilliant book, I think. It's very spare, very quiet, really, and extremely sort of domestic. It's a domestic look at living through a period that we see as a period of huge history. But I actually hope it goes onto the shortlist stage. I think it deserves to.
Tell us a little bit about this, The Unknown Emma Donoghue, which you've been reading overnight.
Yes, this is a fantastic book. It says on the front, and there's a quote from Audrey Niffenegger, "Room is a book to read in one sitting." And I think I probably got about two-thirds of the way through before I fell asleep with it pressed against my face. But it's based loosely on the story of Joseph Fritzl, which we all know, the father who locked his daughter in a room in Austria underground and with her various children. And it's told by a five-year-old, Jack, who is the narrator, and the narrative voice is just absolutely spot on. It's pitch perfect. And it's incredibly upsetting, affecting, and also that thing of really kind of bleak fiction where you think, you know, thank God it's fiction. You can sort of pull yourself out of it. And of course, this is based on fact, which then weaves into it and makes you ask a lot of questions about the process of writing it, why she was moved to write it. I mean, I just think it's completely fascinating and done so well.
Perhaps not the sort of book that you'd want to take on your summer holidays.
The weird thing is, actually, that although it's about the bleakest and darkest and strangest of subjects, it's sort of beautiful because it's told from the point of view of the child who sees his home. He doesn't see a shed in the back garden that he's locked in. He sees the place where he lives with his mother. And the pleasure that he derives from it is kind of uplifting.
Well, we'd love to review all the books for you right now, but alas, it could take some time. So we thought we'd give you miniature tasters of each and every one of the 13 long-listed books in our own special way. You can tell a lot about a book from the first line. So here are the 13 2010 Booker Longlist openers.
Paul Murray. Skippy Dies. Skippy and Ruprecht are having a donut-eating race one evening when Skippy turns purple and falls off his chair.
Tom McCarthy. C. Dr. Learmont, newly appointed general practitioner for the districts of West Maysdown and New Ellery, rocks and jolts on the front seat of a trap as it descends the lightly sloping path of Versoir House.
Emma Donoghue. Room. Today I'm five.
Helen Dunmore, The Betrayal. It's a fresh June morning without a trace of humidity, but Russoff is sweating.
Howard Jacobson, The Finkler Question. He should have seen it coming.
Lisa Moore, February. Helen watches as the man touches the skate blade to the sharpener.
Damon Galgut. In a strange room. It happens like this.
The Long Song by Andrea Levy. It was finished almost as soon as it began.
The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet by David Mitchell. Miss Karazemi. Orito kneels on a stale and sticky
Peter
futon.
Carey. Parrot and Olivier in America. I had no doubt that something cruel and catastrophic had happened before I was even born. Yet the Comte and Comtesse, my parents, would not tell me what it was.
Alan Warner, The Stars in the Bright Sky. With caution, the four young women had silently observed the illuminated hotel signs placed upon the flat roofs along the vague night skylines, even as the bus repeatedly spun on disorientating curved turnpikes and flyovers. The Renaissance, The Thistle, Holiday Inn, The Ramada, The Meridian, The Sky Lane.
The Slap by Christos Tsoulkas. His eyes still shut, a dream dissolving and already impossible to recall. Hector's hand sluggishly reached across the bed.
Trespass by Rose Tremaine. The child's name is Melody.
Only another 100,000 pages to read then. David Mitchell, Sarah, surely it must be David Mitchell's moment.
Well, but then you could equally say it must be Howard Jacobson's moment, or it must be Andrea Levy's moment again. I mean, David Mitchell obviously kind of famously didn't win the Booker a few years back for Cloud Atlas. And I haven't read The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, as I gather it's pronounced, but everyone who has read it said to me that it's very good. Rodney, you've read it, haven't you?
He takes historical fiction to somewhere completely different from anywhere else. It's just, it's demanding, it's fascinating, it's... I'm a big fan, as you may have gathered.
But having had a historical fiction winner last year, how does it compare to that?
That's a really good question. I think they both are completely different periods. And of course, what he is so clever about is that it's very much the closeted island of Japan and these foreigners who are allowed to live on this sort of strange little island off a harbour. And Hilary Mantel, well, it's wonderfully, wonderfully set in Tudor England, and I don't see similarities except they're both wonderful books.
And they both happen to have the H word in front of them, which, you know, history is the world, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Let's move on now to some of the outliers, the more unexpected titles, which people really won't know about. Tom McCarthy, Sarah, where's he come from? This book, C, the letter C, not the C,
yes,
which was John Banville's.
Well, he's going to be reviewed in the Guardian Review this week, if I'm not mistaken. And so, you know, hopefully everyone will go there and find out exactly what this book is all about. But he's his last book, Remainder, was a big critical success. Lots of people really, really rated it and really rate him. And with this book, I think it's interesting. It sort of slightly broadens the scope of the list, I think, and adds to the mix of it in a positive way. Whether or not it will move on to the shortlist stage, I'm not really sure. But it's a... Yeah,
it's sort of high modernism, isn't it?
Exactly.
So in a way, it's in being quite experimental, it's actually quite old-fashioned. It's harking back to the early 20th
century. It's old-fashioned experimentalism, yes.
Which is not a contradiction.
It has got, there is one of the sections, the hero, C, the main character, is a pilot in the First World War, and the descriptions of that flying in these bits of cardboard and string is absolutely astonishing writing. It's got some bravura set pieces. I'm not sure it all hangs together, but it's still a cracking read. Mm. And interestingly, he's been slightly set up as the person who's going to change the face of the novel, and I would be worried if I was him with that now hanging around his neck. But I think he's great. He's really interesting.
So we'll all have to rush off and buy that to
Absolutely,
read on our summer
yes.
holidays. Now, Sarah, the bloggers, we've already put this out to our bloggers, and the commenters have clustered around Mitchell and Christos Tsolkas, really, haven't they?
Yes, Christos Tsolkas, his book The Slap has been sort of held up as the big summer read, you know, what everyone's going to actually be taking to the beach with them this year. And you've read it, haven't you? And you really liked
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I did really like it. I mean, I think it's very televisual.
I gather it's supposedly a sort of bit of a play on Australian soap operas.
Yeah, and it's not a novel that you read for the beauty of the sentences, but it's very visceral. You race through it, and it's, I think, the characterisation of a multinational society so far from Neighbours, if you remember, old enough to remember. That,
if I'm old enough to remember.
Neighbours.
I still watch it sometimes now.
Yeah, I think it's really a really good read. That's one that's been incredibly popular, isn't it?
Yes, we were fortunate and picked it up when it was published in May, and it sold extremely well. And it's now going to be definitely one of the runners on this list.
Mm. Now, two of the most exciting books for me are Skippy Dies, Paul Murray, which is an Irish boarding school comedy tragedy.
Certainly has comicness to it.
But it does involve the main character, the title character dying in the very yes. first scene, if not the first page.
Yes, which is, you know, casts a slight pall, but it's a very funny book. And also, I presume the other book that you're going to mention now is Howard Jacobson, The Finkler Question. Fans of Howard Jacobson will like this book. It's a Howard Jacobson book. It's about Jewishness. It's comedy.
It had a touch of the late Kingsley Amis for me.
That's
sort of curmudgeonly.
Yes. Much
gathering for a sort of bilious dinner party kind of thing, but obviously saying significant things about significant issues.
Jonathan Safran-Foer on this podcast earlier in the year said that he thought that if Howard Jacobson had been born in America, he would be recognised as one of the great American novelists, and it was his misfortune to be born in the UK.
Isn't that fascinating? Because if he wins this, it will be very well deserved. I completely acknowledge that point, and very interesting. Why is it we don't treat comic novelists properly? I don't know.
Yeah.
This is, in a way, a list about comedy, isn't it? It seems to me that, yes. You know, the people always go on about how comic novels never win prizes, but there are loads of them on this list.
Because Andrew Motion, once again, to go back, he said there were three on the list, and I've been racking my brains. I think he must mean Parrot and Oliver in America is the third one.
Rodney, I'm going to ask you to do a quick change and wear your two different hats, and my first question to you is going to be with your bookseller hat on. Which of these books do you think is going to do best for you as booksellers?
I think commercially, I think it's going to be Andrew Levy and David Mitchell, to be honest. I'm just going to stick my neck out on that one.
Now, quick change into your personal hat, your weekend hat. As an enthusiast and a reader, which one are you most excited by?
I think the Damon Galgut, actually, to be honest.
Sarah, now your personal favourite.
It's so hard to choose. There are so many books on this list that I really love. As I said, I was thrilled to see Helen Dunmore on there. I really, really rate Howard Jacobson, and I have a slight feeling that this might be the year for him. This could be the year when he sort of breaks through and actually wins it. But just as a kind of a very small personal thing, as I said earlier on, I'm just really very pleased in a heartfelt way to see Lisa Moore on there, because that's a great book, and so many great books just sort of vanish. And I'm glad to see that this one now won't vanish, and it's getting some of the recognition that it deserves.
Well, may the best woman, or indeed man, win. The shortlist will be out on September the 7th, so you have the whole summer to catch up with reading. To misappropriate an old saw, one prize does not a summer make, and we're also pretty excited about the Forward Prize for Poetry. Sarah took one of the shortlisted poets, Jo Shapcott, off to London's Barts Hospital to talk about her collection, which deals, among other things, with the challenges of facing breast cancer.
We're sitting in the courtyard of St Barts and the London Hospital in Smithfield in London, and it's a sort of bright grey morning and very beautiful surroundings in the middle of the city.
And we're looking straight at a rather amazing Baroque-style marble fountain.
Glorious, isn't it? Lots of fish with water coming out of their mouths.
Yeah, apart from the builders, it's a bit of an inner-city idyll, isn't
it?
Yes,
as you can hear in hospitals, things never sleep. And Joe, we're here to talk about your collection of Mutability. And first of all, congratulations for being shortlisted for this year's Forward Prize.
Thank you. I'm really excited about it. I mean, in the main, because it's been a fantastic year for poetry books. So to be on that list with some of those terrific books is wonderful, an honour.
For listeners who have yet to read your collection, the reason why we're sitting in the courtyard of St Bart's Hospital is because you yourself spent a period of time being treated for breast cancer, not here, but at a different hospital. During that time, how important were your surroundings to you?
I think they're probably very important to anyone who is being treated really for any illness, because you spend a lot of time waiting. And also, something happens, I think, when you have a brush with mortality, whatever it may be. I mean, even if it's not connected directly with you, even if someone close to you dies, there is a kind of heightened sense of awareness of the world around you, I think, just because you're aware you're not here forever. And Dennis Potter spoke wonderfully about this when he was dying. Almost ecstatically, he talked about the blossominess of the blossoms, that now, you know, with only months to stay on this earth, he really, really saw it, maybe for the first time.
And that's something that is very evident in this collection of yours. During the process of the collection, there are hospitals there is hair loss, there are things that a reader who's aware of your history might connect to your illness, but also there is that sense of ecstasy and of seeing the world anew. There are a lot of trees and lots of cups of tea, things
tea,
like that.
Tea, yeah, that's right. And that's what I think the book reflects, the way that kind of brush with mortality sort of wakes you up to the world in a good way. It's not a sad book, it's quite ecstatic at moments. But I think it represents that kind of changed vision. And mutability really only means change. And we often associate it with kind of death and decay and the dark side of change. But it's also that kind of twinkly, lovely kind of mutability, green change.
It's a lovely word.
Yes.
And you weren't actually treated at Barts Hospital, obviously.
No,
you,
I wasn't.
In the acknowledgements to the book, you thank your oncology team at Hereford County Hospital, I think
that's right. Yeah.
Was it important to you to say thank you to them in that way, in the front of your collection? That
very much. I can't speak highly enough of my consultants, or in fact anyone on the team, from the receptionists to the nurses to everybody. The NHS, I love you. Really brilliant. And I think One of the lovely things about my own hospital was that it was small. So they remembered all of us patients. They knew who we were. And, you know, this is a great hospital. I know it does fantastic work, but I'm sure it has to be just a little bit more impersonal than my own experience.
So while you were in hospital, you're a poet, that's what you do. Were you writing poems at the time?
I wasn't. I actually took a bit of a holiday. One of the nice things about having all this treatment, interesting thing about breast cancer is often you're not ill, you don't feel ill until you start the treatment. But then I could have a holiday, and we never rest. It's not a word that is in our lifestyle at all. It's, you know, people go, rest? But actually I could have a rest, and I did. I lay on the sofa and read bad fiction a lot while having chemo and had every excuse. It was fantastic. Other poets who've been through the same thing I know have treated it differently. I was good friends with Julia Darling, the poet, and she wrote, you know, she used to write in the waiting room. She had all that time and she found it a really urgent and interesting place to write. Though that wasn't the same for me. There was a lot of waiting.
Yes, yeah, she died of breast cancer in 2005, too, didn't she?
Yes.
And you and she knew each other from your time in Newcastle.
That's right,
Department of English. And I have a line that she wrote here in an article that she wrote for The Guardian in 2004 when she said, "Poetry is what keeps me afloat. Without poems, my journey through chemotherapy and radiotherapy and the general ups and downs of illness would have been unthinkable." And I know you said that you took a break, actually, from writing, but what about reading? Did you find that reading poetry was something that you continued to do?
Yes, I did. And, you know, I didn't stop being a poet in a way, but I wouldn't say poetry kept me afloat particularly during that experience. I think it's just always kept me afloat, so nothing changed there, both the reading and the writing of it. It's just in me to do that.
And she also, Julia, lobbied for poetry in waiting rooms and in hospitals generally. And we're in the courtyard of St Bart's, and perhaps it's unsurprising that we can't actually see any poetry here, but we were talking at the beginning about the importance of the surroundings here, the pots of flowers, the beautiful fountain, the effect that the surroundings have on you. Do you think it will be a useful addition to have poetry in public places in that way, and particularly in places where people are unwell?
There are many schemes to do that. I mean, it does happen. It would surprise me if we didn't go somewhere around here and find a lot. And not just that, but works of art. There's a lot of public art. I mean, in my own hospital, beautiful paintings and statues. And I think people like to escape into art to take them out of what may be otherwise quite distressing experiences. It can sort of definitely rest and uplift people.
Now, a friend of mine asked me earlier this week whether I would recommend your collection to her to give as a present to a friend of hers who's just begun a period of breast cancer treatment. Did you ever envisage it being useful to people in that
no,
way?
No, not at all. No, no. I would hope that anybody who has had that kind of brush with mortality, whatever it is, and most people have, would find something of interest in it. It would sort of just they'd connect somehow with the experiences of the book. But I mean, you're right, it absolutely is not a kind of manual about how to get through bad times, or it doesn't even mention breast cancer. But it's, you know, and the poem's about a variety of things, from, looking at aspects of the city, looking at trees. One of them is about peeing. And some of them are funny, and so it really isn't. I think people would be disappointed if they thought this was going to help them specifically through a breast cancer diagnosis, because it won't. But it is, there's no doubt, it's tinged with a sense of human mortality, but without being sad about that, maybe actually celebrating that.
And you've actually won the Ford Prize in the past for My Life Asleep.
That's right, yeah.
And that was in 1999, is that
yes.
right? Yes. Would it mean something different for you to win it again now?
I mean, quite honestly, I'm not even thinking of that. I am just really pleased to be on the shortlist. I think it's highly unlikely that it'll win. In fact, I found out, I think there was an article about the prize in The Guardian, and it had a link to Paddy Power. And you can bet on who's going to win. And all I can tell you is I'm very close to the bottom.
Jo, thanks so much for coming to talk to us here at St Bart's today.
It's a pleasure.
That was Sarah Crown with Jo Shapcott. And that's it for today's books podcast. Join us next week for that long-promised audience with Jonathan Raeburn. In the meantime, in Saturday's Guardian Review, you can read Chris Taylor's review of Tom McCarthy's Sea. And The Observer's new review on Sunday looks at fiction's new experimentalists, including, of course, the aforementioned Tom McCarthy. We very much hope you'll join us on the great Booker longlist debate on guardian.co.uk/books and also on Twitter. Until next week, I'm Claire Armistead and the producer is Lucy Greenwell.